From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, a long, deadly, and misguided experiment in medical segregation. We talk with John Taman. His new book, The Colony, is about a leprosy colony on a remote and inaccessible Hawaiian peninsula. It was created in 1865 and lasted for 103 years. We'll also talk about a medical threat we face today, bird flu. Dr. Mark Siegel will tell us why he thinks his patients are worrying too much about it. He's the author of the new book, Bird Flu. Maureen Corrigan reviews a new memoir, whose truth she doesn't doubt. And Kevin Whitehead reviews Cubist Music, the new recording by the pianist Edsel Gomez. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. We're going to hear the story of an infamous leper colony, which my guest John Taman describes as a long, deadly, and misguided experiment in medical segregation. It was located on a remote and inaccessible peninsula on the Hawaiian island of Molokai. For 103 years, beginning in 1866, the Hawaiian government forced people who were diagnosed with leprosy to live there. In his new book, The Colony, John Taman tells the story of this colony and considers what it tells us about public health. He points out that at the time of the colony, leprosy was believed to always be highly contagious, which we now know is not true. In part to destigmatize the disease, it is now referred to as Hansen's disease. The Hawaiian king signed into law an act to prevent the spread of leprosy, which criminalized the disease. What did the law say?
The law gave the Hawaiian government the right to arrest, imprison, and exile anybody they thought had the disease.
Is this a precedent-making law? Are there other laws that you know of that actually criminalized having a disease?
No, the law wasn't unique. Other countries had done somewhat similar things, but the king arrived at this idea primarily on the counsel of his American and European advisors, and they were reacting with some amount of panic to what they thought was an impending epidemic of leprosy.
Why did they think that an epidemic was imminent?
Well, the government was a little sensitive to epidemics of any sort because they had suffered through a series of them that had essentially halved the population in the islands from the time of first contact. It was estimated that about 350,000 Hawaiians lived there before the first white settlers came and the missionaries. And by the time they began to see an increased number of leprosy patients, that population had fallen to 150,000. And so, in part because the king was terribly concerned that the remainder of his people were going to be wiped out, he listened to his advisors, and the advisors said, the only way we can do this is to round up everybody who has the disease, put them in this island prison, and let the disease die itself out.
Now, you think that this exile was based on several misunderstandings of leprosy. What were the misunderstandings?
Well, at the time that they passed the law, they knew very little about the disease, and the law remained in effect not only through the Hawaiian government, but after America annexed the islands, and indeed after it became a state, and some of those misconceptions about the disease itself remained in place. Probably the biggest one was that leprosy was rampantly contagious. In fact, it's a very, very difficult disease to catch, and 95% of the population has a natural immunity. The other thing is that everybody they sent away, they assumed was infectious. And in fact, again, there are different degrees of leprosy. And as it turned out, of the more than 8,000 people they sent away to this island prison to die, more than half of them probably didn't have to be there. They were either misdiagnosed or they had the disease in a form that wasn't contagious.
Would you describe the disease that's now called Hansen's disease? During most of the historical period you're writing about, it was called leprosy. But would you describe the different forms of the disease and the different stages of it?
Sure. It's a chronic infectious disease that's caused by a germ. And typically what happens is that you inhale that germ like you would a common cold or tuberculosis. And then once, if you're susceptible to the disease and once it takes hold, it attacks the skin and the nerves. Now, the germ, the bacteria itself, reproduces best at cooler temperatures, and so it tends to move to the far regions of the body, the fingers and hands and the nose and the eyelids and the cheeks. And when it begins to multiply rapidly, it can cause disfigurement. Of course, in the 1940s, they did create a cure, and it's a multi-drug therapy that arrests the disease within a day of your taking it, and it stops any further disfigurement. Nonetheless, the disease is still relatively common in the United States. It's more prevalent than measles right now. And there's about 7,000 people who either have or have had the disease in the U.S.
The old stereotype of leprosy is that your fingers fall off and your toes and, you know, your earlobes. And how much truth is there to that?
Not very. What happens is that you lose the sensitivity. You lose what doctors call the gift of pain in your fingers and toes. And so where you and I might touch a hot plate or a sharp piece of glass and immediately feel the danger of that and yank our hands away, people with the disease aren't able to react that way, and so they are continually traumatizing their fingers and toes. I write in the book that on average, a typical person injures themselves 4,000 times in their lifetime, and most of that is everything from paper cuts to small burns and whatnot. Well, with somebody who doesn't have the feeling in their hands and feet, that number doubles or triples, and it's the constant trauma, the constant damage that they're doing to their fingers and toes that causes the blunting. So the myth that they're dropping fingers and toes and arms and legs in the street is just that, it's a myth.
Was there any way of empirically diagnosing the disease?
For many years, no. Certainly for the first 50 years or so, they had no clear way of determining whether you had it. Leprosy is caused by a particular bacteria, and it's relatively straightforward. It attacks the skin and nerves, and if it's left untreated, it can cause partial paralysis and insensitivity and blindness and some disfigurement. There's a cure now, of course, but until the early 1920s, they really had no bacteriological method of determining if you had the disease. When they finally did find one, they allowed people to be re-diagnosed, and of the first 11 people that they re-diagnosed, all 11 turned out not to have the disease. Many of them had been in exile for 20 years already.
Would you describe the peninsula that was chosen for the leper colony?
Sure. Robert Louis Stevenson called it a prison fortified by nature, and that's very much what it was. Molokai is the island between the islands of Maui and Oahu, and it's a relatively small, very underpopulated island. The northern side of that island boasts the highest sea cliffs in the world, these 3,000-foot green walls that sort of leap up from the sea. And about midway along the coast, there is a little triangle of flat land that emerges, about 2 miles by 2 miles. And it was relatively barren, and it had only a few residents on it. And so one of the original members of the Board of Health, who knew the island from his time as a traveling doctor in the islands, suggested that this would be an ideal place to send away these people. It's impossible to land on it because the seaside borders of the island are ringed by lava rock, and there's no natural landing or natural beach. And so the only way in is down this giant cliff, or to try and pilot a little whaleboat to an edge of the peninsula and make your way in that way. It was very treacherous, and many people died.
So you're pretty well guaranteed of being kept very remote from the rest of the world.
It was. It was like the government intentionally shipwrecked these people.
So what happened to you if you were diagnosed with leprosy? What could you expect after that?
Well, nothing good, quite frankly. The government sent out tax collectors, sheriffs, other sorts of government agents, and in a few cases doctors, to comb the islands and identify anyone they suspected of having the disease. There was a master list that was kept. And based on that list, they decided whether you were a candidate to be exiled or not. And so essentially, these were businessmen, parents, and children who were pulled from their homes and from their offices and classrooms even. And they were marched down to the waterfront, locked into cattle stalls on livestock supply ships, and then sailed across the channel and left to die on this prison.
Okay, so the people who are quarantined to this peninsula, they're living in a place that is incredibly remote and hard to get to. They're not farmers or anything. I mean, what do they eat?
Well, the government actually thought they were going to be farmers. They thought the colony would be self-sufficient. And so on the first day when the first 12 people were dumped on shore and they straggled to shore, sort of soaked through with seawater and damp and blinking with shock, the resident overseer that the government had hired to literally just sort of be a sort of prison guard handed them a shovel or a hoe and a blanket. And then he marched them across to this abandoned village and told them to start making it their home. And they were expected to farm enough and raise enough crops to feed themselves. And what the government had neglected to realize was not only were these people not in the best shape to be effective farmers, many of them were weak and already ill, but the moment they did start getting together some crops and managing to get enough to sustain themselves, another boatload of people would show up, and immediately things fell into shortage. And so literally for the first decade or two, people were starving. There was constant daily shortages that were met with riots and rebellions and threats of murdering the resident superintendent, and it was an awful situation.
So what was the society like that developed in this colony of exiled sick people?
Well, in the early days, it was something like something from Lord of the Flies, where the strongest and most brutal held sway. And there were murders and riots and moonshiners and rape and prostitution. But within 5 or 6 or 7 years, the population grew to the point where there were more and more people who realized that if we are going to be a community, we have to make that community ourselves. They were civilizers, to use the phrase. And so they put in place a rough form of government. They had a sort of legislature for themselves, and they created a small police force to try and keep the people who didn't want to be lawful in place. And they began to sort of split into different factions that some farmed, some fished, some tried to build shelter for the others. The people who were educated could read and send letters off, or in time try and file lawsuits to get themselves out. By the 1900s, it was almost like a typical small American town that just happened to be filled with people who either had the disease or the government thought they had the disease.
Did people marry and have children within the colony? And are there people who grew up as the children of the people who were exiled there who never knew any other life?
There were marriages and childbirths in the peninsula, and at various times the government would take the newborn away from the family at 1 year old and send them up the cliff and then place them in a hospital on what's known as Topside Molokai, which is the remainder of the island of Molokai. And then they were placed in foster homes or in orphanages. They later found out one of the genetic quirks that enables you to catch the disease follows along familial lines. So in some families, it is much easier to catch the disease. And in fact, some of the children who either were born there or had relatives there also came down with the disease. And so some have spent almost their entire life in exile.
You know, I think some people would assume that a place that was a colony for people who were then diagnosed with leprosy would be a place in which terribly disfigured people, people who look quite grotesque, were walking around. I think when people think of leprosy, they think of the worst images that they've ever seen. So what percent do you think of people who were sentenced to live on this peninsula were really hideously disfigured?
Much smaller than you would imagine. If you walked around the community, more than half of the people would look no different than a normal, healthy person. Leprosy doesn't manifest itself as disfigurement in every case, and so you had not only the people who never had the disease, but they were in exile anyway, but you had the ones that had the disease in a mild form, who were not contagious and didn't come into any of the disfigurement. Nonetheless, it's interesting, is that some of the most disfigured patients took advantage of their appearance to terrorize not only the current residents, but any newcomer. Often the boats that would spill the patients to shore would arrive at Kalapapa in the dark, either late in the evening or very early in the morning. And the more disfigured patients took advantage of that fact and would gather on shore with torches and stand in the darkness, cackling as the boats were heading towards shore, and screaming, "In this place there is no law." And as such, they managed to cow anybody who came and immediately would rob them or take their belongings.
My guest is John Taman, author of The Colony. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is John Taman. His new book, The Colony, is about a leprosy colony on a remote and inaccessible peninsula on the Hawaiian island of Molokai. For 103 years, beginning in 1868, Hawaiians diagnosed with the disease were forced to live there. Now, several missionaries were sent to the colony. Was this considered a very difficult assignment for the missionaries?
It was. I mean, at the time, what they knew about the disease implied that anybody who went to serve there was accepting a death sentence, that they were martyring themselves. That didn't necessarily have to be the case. But the most famous missionary is a man named Father Damien, a Catholic priest. The Catholic mission in the islands decided that there were 200 or so Catholics, and they needed the presence of a priest to take confession and to see to their needs. And Damien volunteered to go. And so at age 33, he entered the community, and he was the real first full-time priest to stay.
He ended up getting leprosy himself.
He did. He happened to be part of the 5% that lacked a natural immunity, and he freely intermingled with obviously infectious cases and passed his pipe around and ate from a communal bowl. He did so in part because he felt to do otherwise wouldn't allow him to be a priest. They had this thing, it was interesting in reporting the book, I saw it from the very early documents, not only in letters from the exiles themselves, but in the doctor's reports, and I later experienced it myself. They subjected visitors, newcomers, to something that might be called a handshake test. And when you entered the colony for the first time, people would come up and offer their hands. And depending upon how you reacted, that determined how they were going to treat you during your stay. If you shied away or if you pulled on your gloves, as many people did, you were treated with disdain and a tourist and essentially ignored. But if you did put out your hand and shake it and knew enough either to know that this was not a danger or that you were willing to accept that danger in order to do good, then they embraced you and welcomed you into the community. Damien, of course, sort of did his own version of that and immediately became a full member of the community. When he finally did catch the disease, he of course, began to describe himself as "we lepers" in his sermons, and that became really part of his legacy.
I'd like to ask you before we go any further about the word that we're both using, which is leprosy. The disease is usually referred to now as Hansen's disease, named after the person who discovered the cause of it. Is it considered inappropriate now to use the word leprosy? I think we're both, I know you use it in your book because you're using the time-appropriate language. And I'm using it because you're using it, I guess. So I'll just blame it on you. are we
well,
inadvertently offending anybody by using that word? I mean, is it considered wrong to use the word now?
It should be used with caution. As you mentioned, leprosy is now known in part by an alternate name, and that's Hansen's disease. It's named for the doctor who discovered the germ that causes the disease. But the word leper itself is loaded with so much power, it's become something like a racial epithet. And many victims of the disease feel that way. They're offended each time they hear it. It's an easy reaction to understand. Here are a group of people that simply had the misfortune to catch a germ. And for the rest of their lives, they're known foremost as lepers, the most powerful metaphor for otherness there is. And so when I use it in the colony, I make sure to use it either in its direct historical context or within a direct quotation. And in fact, the usage of the word begins to disappear as societal attitudes change. And so by the 1930s and 1940s, it appears not at all. And toward the end of the book, the people I write about are referred to exclusively as residents of the community of Kalapapa rather than lepers in a leper colony.
Who lives there now?
27 residents remain there, and their people in there, the average age is 72. They've been there most of their lives, 50, 60, 70 years, and they were sent away as children, and they're there by choice, in part because it is so magnificently beautiful. It's a quiet, lovely little town. Their friends are around them, and over the years, they've managed to make a loving community out of what had been some of the most harrowing circumstances imaginable. it's impossible to meet and talk with these people and not be overwhelmed by their strength and the power of their faith.
Now, you've written about a whole colony of people who were quarantined, and you've written this at a time when we're hearing about the possibility of quarantine in America if there is a bird flu, if there is a terrorist attack with smallpox. What are some of the lessons that the quarantined community you wrote about have for us today?
Well, the main lesson is that you can't let public hysteria drive policy. And that's what led to the creation of this colony, and it's what led to 8,000 people having their lives destroyed when most of it was needless. At the time I started the book, of course, I didn't really have any idea that there would be a current relevance to it when it came out specific to avian flu. As I discovered, one of the first instances of instruction for quarantine and isolation occurs in the Old Testament, where they give details on how to isolate lepers. Now, one of the terrible ironies is that in the Bible, the people who were described as lepers actually don't have the disease leprosy. And so, unfortunately, time and again you see governments reacting the same way when they're faced with an infectious or scary disease. It happened recently with SARS. It happened in the early 1980s during the first days of the AIDS crisis, when on a government level there was discussion of exiling everybody they thought had AIDS to the colony and turning it into a national AIDS colony.
Well, John Taman, thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you for having me on.
John Taman is the author of the new book, The Colony. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Support for NPR comes from Audible.com, where you can download and listen to Fresh Air, in addition to audiobooks, magazines, and newspapers. Audible.com/fresh air. From Endless Pools, the treadmill for swimmers, installed indoors or out. DVD available at 888-882-SWIM or endlesspool.com. And from GM, committed to energy independence with vehicles that run on 85% ethanol and 15% gasoline. Details at onlygm.com. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, Dr. Mark Siegel tells us why he thinks his patients are worrying too much about bird flu. He's the author of the new book, Bird Flu. Maureen Corrigan reviews a memoir, which he doesn't doubt is true. And Kevin Whitehead reviews Cubist Music, the new CD by the pianist Edsel Gomez. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Marianne Tyrone Smith has had a long career as a writer of literary fiction and detective novels. Her new memoir, Girls of Tender Age, demonstrates for book critic Maureen Corrigan the truth in the old writing adage that the best stories are the ones closest to home. Here's Maureen's review.
I read Marianne Tyrone Smith's spellbinding new memoir, Girls of Tender Age, smack in the middle of the James Frey expose, yet never once did I wonder if she was making up any of the events she describes. My lack of critical wariness doesn't derive from defeatism. I'm not one of those what-is-truth-anyway types who think that every memoir is just a variant of fiction. In fact, I went on the record 2.5 years ago on this program saying that memoirs have a responsibility to try to tell the truth, utopian as that effort might be. I was commenting on Vivian Gornick's public admission that she had invented some scenes and conversations in her revered memoir, Fierce Attachments. In the aftermath of Oprah's recent televised horsewhipping of Fry, many more people are jumping on the truth in autobiography bandwagon, some of them sanctimoniously and belatedly. Cynics and deconstructionists are running for cover. Crowds of the earnest and outraged are shouting foul play and taking the field. Someday soon, we scholarly types may feel free to use the word truth in literary discussions again without making those little quotation mark signs around that word. I don't doubt the truth of Marianne Tyrone Smith's memoir, because aside from the fact that she's telling me that this is a recollection of her Italian-French working-class Catholic childhood in New Haven, Connecticut in the 1950s, she's also writing this book as a kind of sacred and profane memorial to her classmate Irene, who was murdered at age 11 by a convicted sex offender prowling Tyrone Smith's neighborhood. Irene was snatched by this monster from the streets one evening in 1953 as she was walking home from the neighborhood store carrying potatoes that her mother wanted for dinner. Her body was discovered early the next morning in a yard a couple of fences over from Tyrone Smith's house. That day at school, Tyrone Smith recalls, her teacher announced to the fifth graders that there will be no speaking of Irene. Then the maintenance man came in and carried Irene's desk out of the classroom, and all the kids moved up a space. Class resumed. As Tyrone Smith says, Irene was killed twice, murdered by a horrific man, and then erased by the era that was the 50s. All who needed to talk about her silenced. Tyrone Smith wants to use her memoir in traditional fashion to break that silence by speaking the truth. But there's a danger inherent in a project like this. The danger is that Tyrone Smith might seem opportunistic, taking advantage of her own proximity to tragedy to give her life story a sensational gloss. Not to worry. The first page, no, the very first sentence of Girls of Tender Age establishes a voice and worldview so sure, so complex, that Irene's story, awful as it is, seems of a piece with the simultaneously nostalgic, violent, and loony sense of the 1950s this memoir evokes. Tyrone Smith opens her book with this comment that will resonate with so many readers of a certain age and class. She says, "Here is how my father describes our socioeconomic level. Working stiffs." When was the last time you heard that phrase? Tyrone Smith goes on to resurrect other time capsule artifacts of her particular corner of the 1950s, which included life with her older brother Tyler, who, as she says, is autistic at a time when no one has ever heard of autism. Tyler is a World War II savant who carries on conversations via a Campbell's noodle soup can, his red phone, with FDR about troop casualties. Tyrone Smith's mother emotionally and physically flees the family, working the housewife shift from 3:30 p.m. to 10 p.m. at a nearby insurance company and then playing in midnight bowling leagues. Her father is a sweetheart of a guy who takes up the slack and keeps himself going day and night with gallons of percolated coffee and the occasional grappa. Tyrone Smith stands as intelligent witness to it all here. She tells the truth, at least she's got me convinced she does, but she also skillfully tells it slant, looking back at a remove of some 50 years in longing, avowed anger, and tough girl humor.
Maureen Corrigan teaches literature at Georgetown University and is the author of the memoir, Leave Me Alone, I'm Reading. She reviewed Girls of Tender Age by Marianne Tyrone Smith. Coming up, Dr. Mark Siegel, author of the new book, Bird Flu. This is Fresh Air. In his new book, Bird Flu, Dr. Mark Siegel says it's good to be prepared for worst-case scenarios, but, he says, fear itself is its own virus and can cause far more damage than influenza. In his previous book, False Alarm, Siegel wrote about the epidemic of fear and how anxieties are often disproportionate to the actual threats we face. Dr. Siegel is a practicing internist and an associate professor at the New York University School of Medicine. How come you seem to be less worried about the spread of bird flu than a lot of other health experts are?
The answer is that I'm not unafraid of avian influenza in general. I think it's a bug well worth being concerned about. My issue is that I'm not making the broad leap to believe that H5N1, which there's several steps that have to occur before this bird flu can put multitudes at risk and millions at risk. First of all, it has to mutate to a form that goes easily human to human, which hasn't occurred. Then if it does go through that mutation, it may in fact mutate out of the form where it's really killing people. We don't know whether those things are going to happen.
If the bird flu did spread, are there things that we could do now, I'm sure there are, that couldn't be done in 1918 during the flu pandemic that killed millions of people?
Absolutely, Terry. You know, in 1918, yes, there were less people than now. Yes, we have more elderly now. Yes, we have travel, as we're constantly being reminded. We travel around the planet at great rates. But what we haven't that we didn't have in 1918, and this is very crucial, we have antibiotics, and 50% of the birth certificates in 1918 said pneumonia on them. Now, I don't know how many of those were bacterial pneumonia, but we can assume a vast number were. We have treatments for heart disease, and heart disease killed a lot of people that had the flu in 1918. We have steroids to treat people in respiratory failure, which they get from flu, which they got in 1918. We have public health announcements. You know, in 1918, people weren't even sure what a virus was, and they huddled together at draft rallies during World War I, and of course the virus was also spread in trenches, and it was spread among very, very poor people. There's not the same concern of lack of public information. Not only that, the government in 1918 was suppressing information. The government was telling people this is nothing to worry about. We have the opposite problem now.
What are some of the worries that your patients have spoken to you about that you think are really unnecessary worries?
One of the reasons I got interested in writing about this bird flu in general is that I was alarmed at how many people are talking about this and not worrying about the things that I'm actually treating them for. I mean, people with heart disease and obesity, people that are smoking, that I'm trying to get quit smoking, are coming in asking if they're going to get bird flu. Can they have Tamiflu? And I say, what about the yearly flu? I mean, the yearly flu kills over 36,000 people every year, and they're not concerned about the yearly flu. It took me a long time to actually get some of my patients to agree to take the flu shot this year because they weren't thinking about the flu. They were thinking about bird flu. And this fear is way out of proportion to the risk. And of course, I tell people not a single bird in the United States has this.
There are antivirals like Tamiflu that are being discussed in connection with dealing with a pandemic if there were to be one. How does Tamiflu work?
Well, Tamiflu is an antiviral drug. It is called a neuraminidase inhibitor. It blocks the spread of viruses, flu viruses, from one cell to the next, and it is usually effective against all influenza. In this particular bird flu, it has not yet been proven to work. Actually, a review study in one of the major British journals last week pointed out that it has not been proven to work, but it has been proven to work in animals, in mice and in ferrets. And there's every reason to believe that it would be somewhat effective at high doses at this bird flu. But it is not a panacea. There's also no reason for anybody to be taking it right now if they're not exposed to this virus. And the only people that have been shown to be exposed to this virus are bird handlers in countries where the disease is endemic in birds.
So is Tamiflu a cure? Does it stop the progression of the disease once you've had it? Does it prevent you from getting it in the first place?
Tamiflu would work for bird flu presumably the same way it works for yearly flu. It's mainly used within the first 24 to 48 hours after you come down with symptoms. After that, it doesn't tend to work. It decreases the length that you would have the disease by about a day or two and probably decreases the mortality somewhat. It is the only antiviral drug that has been approved for prevention, but I also think that that's led to tremendous overuse of the drug in Asia because everybody that thinks they may be near the flu at all has taken it. Millions and millions of doses of it have been used, and I'm concerned about resistance occurring, as has already occurred with an older flu drug known as amantadine. So we need to actually keep Tamiflu for when we would really need it, both in terms of the yearly flu and in terms of a bird flu pandemic. It's one of the reasons I'm not a fan of personal stockpiles, because I don't know when my patients would take it. I don't like, in general, the idea of patients stockpiling medications. I prefer the idea of keeping the physician in the loop, if possible. Government stockpiles of Tamiflu make some sense, except that there again, you're sending the message that something imminent is about to happen. I'm more in favor of long-term preparation.
We have flu vaccines every year. Some years they're more effective than others. I know you need advanced time to make an effective vaccine, and you need to know what you're inoculating against, what's the strain of flu. Since we have some advance warning that there is this new strain of bird flu, is it possible we would have a vaccine prepared by the time the bird flu jumped to the human species, if it ever does really jump in a major threatening way?
Well, you know, the problem is that we currently make vaccines using a chicken-egg medium where we inoculate eggs against the virus. And as you might imagine, that causes a problem because the virus is an avian flu and it kills eggs. So we need to use millions of eggs and it takes 6 to 9 months. And this process has been around since the 1950s and it really needs to be upgraded using cell culture where we use mammalian cells and we inject them with a genetically engineered virus, which we have the ability to use. We use it for hepatitis B and chickenpox, and we certainly could use it for flu. Without that, there's a too long a lead time. Now, we currently have a bird flu vaccine, but if H5N1 mutates, it's hard to say how effective that vaccine would be. We could produce vast quantities of it in several months, but it may not be that effective. The yearly flu vaccine right now is only usually about 40 to 60% effective against the flu. So we tend to see it as a panacea, but it is really not. It is a useful tool, not a panacea.
The president has called for $2.7 billion to be put toward the manufacture of vaccines. Would that help in an effective way to transfer to this new technology that you're describing?
You know, I think that that's actually a good part of the president's plan. I think $2.7 billion is a very good start towards going over to modern technology using cell culture, genetic technology, or even the newer vaccines that are out there that are in the works that may actually be able to provide a vaccine against all influenza for a 10-year period. That's currently in the works. So I think that's great. But it doesn't address the more fundamental problem, which is we're relying on the vaccine manufacturers, and there's very few of them right now, actually only three. And the problem is that they're afraid of lawsuits. And I think that the solution is more government involvement the way we have in Western Europe, where the government actually takes control of vaccine manufacturer and assures a certain amount per year and distribution. Without that, we're kind of in trouble. These are generic products. They don't have a large profit margin. And we can't really assure a rapid turnaround of vaccine manufacturer, especially in an emergency situation.
You're saying you don't think that there's enough of a profit motive for commercial pharmaceutical companies to invest a lot in the development of new vaccines?
You know, I think that that's been seen by the fact that there used to be 27 flu vaccine manufacturers in the 1970s in the United States, and now there's three. It's partly because it's a generic product. They can't make a lot of profit on it. It's partly because it's very highly regulated, and it's partly because they have liability concerns.
Well, the president has also proposed ending those liability concerns by making them not liable for any side effects that the vaccine may cause.
Well, this may sound counterintuitive, but I'm not really for that idea. I think somebody's got to be liable. I mean, we don't want to make the public be liable. So if the government assumes the liability, that's fine, provided that there's a liability concern. I mean, we can't just say, you know, we can't promote a panic, overreact, vaccinate millions of people, and then say, well, no one's liable. That's actually a concern that occurred during the swine flu fiasco in 1976, where a virus that never actually came caused such a panic that 40 million people were vaccinated over a month and a half time, and over 1,000 cases of ascending paralysis appeared to result.
Why is it so difficult, and I'm glad it is difficult, but why is it so difficult for the flu virus to jump from birds to a form that can infect humans?
Let's clarify that, because there's thousands of bird flu viruses out there, and our yearly flu actually is generally a bird virus, at least all the influenza A viruses are, and that's the current yearly flu, what we're calling the California flu this year. That's an avian A. That's an influenza A. That is a bird virus. So it's not that it's so hard for bird viruses to jump to human. In fact, the pig is a very common vector for that to occur. Pig mixes both human and bird viruses, and you sometimes get your yearly flu that way. But it's a misassumption to assume that you can pick a certain virus and say that's the one that's going to do it. Now, flu viruses mutate a lot. They change a lot, which is one of the reasons it's worth having scientists track this virus. I am concerned about it, but I would take this point to emphasize that there hasn't been enough distinction made between birds getting this virus and people. And, you know, we've had about 160 people, but millions of birds. In fact, I focus my book, an entire chapter called Bird's Eye View, where I look at the veterinarian response. You know, it might be worth considering that the main experts in the world on avian influenza are actually vets, and many of them work for the USDA and are doing big research on this. And I talked to them and interviewed several of them, and I'm absolutely convinced that the biggest attempt has to be made to control this in the bird population. More vaccinating of birds, more international cooperation targeting birds, more killing or culling of birds, but not all birds. I mean, not, you know, you go out and kill every chicken in sight, you know, more scientific approaches to that. And that's where the money really, really should go.
You know how you've talked about how some people you believe are hyping the avian flu because you think that they have an agenda of their own, for instance, that, you know, researchers might hype it because there'll be more research and money if people are more worried about the spread of flu. And here's what I'm thinking. Your thing is that we have an epidemic of fear, that we're too worried about things and that we're worried disproportionately. So like, you have a vested interest in a way of telling us not to worry about bird flu, because your thing is that we worry too much.
That's a very fair question, Terry, and maybe one of the best questions I've ever been asked. But the truth is that I'm not saying we have nothing to worry about. I'm saying that if we want fear to work properly as a warning system, we ought to use it against the things that are directly threatening us. And I think animals know that a lot better than we do. And we could talk about the things that I think are really threats, like obesity, like, you know, the automobile, maybe nuclear weapons. I mean, that's something that can harm us out of proportion to the risk. We need a scale. We need to say how many people can be affected by that thing, and what is the likelihood of it actually happening? That's a simple scale. With bird flu, it's worth looking at seriously because a lot of people can be affected, but the chances of it are small, so you have to factor that in as well. It's not that my vested interest is it promoting that we don't overreact at all. It's that we learn to overreact to certain things and not others.
Mark Siegel, thank you very much for talking with us.
I've greatly enjoyed it. Thank you.
Dr. Mark Siegel is the author of Bird Flu. Coming up, jazz critic Kevin Whitehead reviews a new CD by the pianist Edsel Gomez. This is Fresh Air. pianist Edsel Gomez was born in Puerto Rico and went to music school in Boston, where he began an ongoing association with clarinetist Don Byron. Then Gomez spent 10 years working in Brazil before moving to New York, where he joined the band of saxophonist David Sanchez. The week Gomez's CD came out, he was playing jazzed-up Mozart in Vienna. Jazz critic Kevin Whitehead says Edsel Gomez's music doesn't sit in one place either.
Edsel Gomez calls his new album Cubist music, by analogy with Picasso's cubism, with its geometric forms, fragmentation, and multiple perspectives on the same material. Gomez gets into the same spirit of deconstructive reconstruction. The tune we just heard, NYC Taxi Ride, is this cubist revamp of Caravan by Duke Ellington and Juan Tizol. For Gomez, cubism involves building tunes and solos out of small blocks, a few short, distinct, and theoretically unrelated motifs, which he calls unitifs. The idea is to bypass the traditional jazz practice of just improvising over a tune's chords, though the players take care of that, too. Steve Wilson on alto saxophone, with a super good rhythm section of bassist Drew Gress, who can play pretty much anything and in tune, and drummer Bruce Cox, whose cockamamie accents nail that cubist vibe. But in the end, it's the music, not the method, that grabs you. Edsel Gomez employs five top reed players on his new album, usually grouped in twos or threes, including saxist David Sanchez and Greg Tardy. They all sound fine here, especially clarinetist Don Byron, who also produced the album. Don Byron on Edsel Gomez's Ladybug. Now, Gomez knows the improvisers he hires are going to break the rules and go their own way sometimes, and that's okay. Whatever works. But elsewhere, you can hear how his unitifs shape the music in interesting ways. A highlight of the album is his tribute to the Puerto Rican co-composer of Caravan, called Juan Tizol. It's a vehicle for alto saxophonist Miguel Zenon, also from Puerto Rico. Gomez's bird call-like piano figures echo Duke Ellington, who was fond of minas and mockingbirds himself. There is something Ellingtonian in the way Edsel Gomez balances the needs of the composer and the improviser in his band, and in his command of recombinant instrumental colors. His album Cubist Music, on the Zoho label, is one of the brightest jazz records I've heard in a while. Rich textures, catchy tunes, meaty solos. Why can't they all be this good?
Kevin Whitehead teaches English and American Studies at the University of Kansas, and he's a jazz columnist for eMusic.com. He reviewed Cubist Music by pianist Edsel Gomez on the Zoho label. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Monique Nazareth, Anne-Marie Baldonado, Ian Chillog, Patty Leswing, and Sam Brigger. I'm Terry Gross.
Support for NPR comes from Barnes & Noble, publishers of the Barnes & Noble Classics edition of Emily Bronte's Wuthering Heights, available in stores and online at bn.com. From the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, and from Jane and Gerald Catcher for the NPR Fund for New Initiatives, helping to develop NPR's new programming and new media. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Tonight, the bottle let me down.
The Grammys will give Lifetime Achievement Awards next week to Merle Haggard, David Bowie, and Cream. On the next Fresh Air, we hear from Haggard, Bowie, and Eric Clapton. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.
True friend, I thought I'd